Good morning, everyone. Thank you for calling in to the Pulmonary Tap phone conference this morning. This is Lorelei Dorian speaking, and with me I have Ashley and Sarah and Tarun from NQF. And before we get started, I might just run through to do a roll call so we know who's on the line with us.
Great.
First, I'll go through the TAP members. Kurt, you're there, right?
Yeah, sure am.
Okay, Janet?
Yes.
Jereen?
Yes.
Great. Catherine?
Yes.
Dale?
Yes.
Zach?
Here.
Great. Linus?
Yes, hi.
Wonderful. Michael?
Yes.
Great. And Richard? Okay, great. And from ABMS, I believe, do you guys want to introduce yourself?
Kevin Weiss starting the call.
Morning, Kevin.
And Todd Lee.
Wonderful. Great. Thanks. Is there anybody else on the call? Okay. Well, we might, as everybody knows, just as a reminder, we're reviewing 5 ABMS pulmonary measures this morning. And you do know, I think, that ABMS have withdrawn all of their measures, so we are doing this as a professional courtesy. So we do really appreciate the time that you're going to give to discuss these measures this morning, and I know that ABMS appreciates it as well, and hopefully we'll be able to provide them with some constructive feedback at the end of this call. So I think there's not really any reasons, unless you guys have any questions, that we shouldn't just jump right into the first measure. Okay, I have the first measure as being 1577, which is the episode of care for patients with asthma over a one-year period. Kurt, did you want to
Sure.
leading this? I know that we have the measure assignments as well that you guys have reviewed,
yeah.
Specific parts, and we're just going to be looking mainly at scientific acceptability today.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think the measure, the importance of the measure is very well clear, is very clear. I think the ABMS, especially under Kevin, has had an excellent team involved, and I think they've clearly stated the importance of the measure for, and as it, particularly as it applies to resource use, not only as it applies to the clinical importance. So I would rate that very high. Do we have up our?
We won't actually be rating this morning, but we will just be discussing each of the criteria within scientific acceptability.
So is it just mainly for feedback then? And
Yes.
And okay.
So I think they did an excellent job stating that. I think we have Michael, Catherine, and Jereen to handle the this measure. If perhaps we could start off, Michael, with reviewing the scientific acceptability. You and Catherine can split that up according to the different aspects.
Right.
Sure.
So I think I had a 2A1, and it appeared to me that the 2A1 could be rated high. I believe the standard costs are an advantage, and so I think that it can be implemented consistently within and across organizations, and I think that the statistical review was comfortable with this aspect of reliability as well. So I didn't have anything else on 2A1. I think, Catherine, were you doing 2A2?
Right, yep. I have 2A2. And 2A2 is the reliability testing demonstrates that the results are repeatable, producing the same results in a high proportion of time when assessed by the same in the same population in the same period of time, and or that this measure score is precise. So they had 2 data samples. One was from MarketScan, and one was the WHIO DataMart database. And the MarketScan was well described in the supplemental materials. These were the PowerPoint slides or the slides that were provided by ABMS. So it was real clear that the WHIO DataMart sample wasn't as well described, so it was a little bit harder to see if the two groups were going to be comparable. The other kind of issue that I had with the MarketScan, and this may or may not be an issue, but they had, from their initial population, they had 0.8 million enrollees that had an asthma claim, and in addition, they had 2.9 million enrollees that had one or more asthma medications prescribed in 2006. But once they whittled it down and excluded all the patients who were not to be included in the analysis, only 244,000 patients were available, which was 53% of their total. And this is on pages 4 and the slides 4 and 5 of their supplemental material. So I only wondered then if this small group was going to be representative of their whole group that they wanted to represent. So that was mainly a question. The other part of the data and sample that even the statistician brought up had to do with determining the costs by the provider. And the way that they set this up was that they looked for patients in whom there was primarily one provider could be assigned to that episode. And it looked like that only 23% of the episodes could be attributed primarily to one provider. So I, again, wasn't sure with such a low percentage if they were going to be able to get good reproducible results. And ABMS can probably respond to that at some point. And so the statistician had also agreed with that, that it may preclude some adequate assessments within the peer group. Then I did have some specific questions on the slides, and the first one I had was on slide number 16. And slide number 16 was titled Asthma Inpatient Admissions. And they listed a lot of, and this is where just my unfamiliarity with how these things are determined probably comes in. But they had for their ICD-9 codes, they had, you know, asthma, pneumonia, COPD with an exacerbation. But then they also had other things that weren't related, like diverticulitis, lumbar disc displacement, sickle cell with crisis. And I wasn't sure why they were included in this, unless it was just when these patients were admitted for asthma, they had these other diagnoses as well. So that part just wasn't clear to me and how that related. And then on slide number 18.
ABMS, do you want to respond to that while we're on that? And I have the slide up.
Well, there's been a number of good questions. I don't know if you want to go through them, and then we can try and take notes and then respond. They seem to be falling into two general buckets. One has to do with the issues that relate to the approach to analysis on our data set, and they'll probably be important to address those because those will be consistent throughout the measures. And then there are some very specific ones, like the last question about how the inpatient costs were accrued. And so how would you like to proceed with that? It seems to me that it might be okay just to hear all the thoughts and then try and maybe address them, or do you want to just pick them off one by one?
This is Catherine. From my perspective, it might be better just to wait and then hear it in a, you know, kind of a more systematic way from ABMS.
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah, let's do that. That's great, yeah.
So going on, then on slide 18, this is the slide that has asthma drug costs by therapeutic class. And on this slide, the different classes of asthma medications, anything for respiratory diseases, rather, are included, except I didn't see a category for leukotriene modifiers or a category for biologics like Xolair, omalizumab. So I don't know if that was lumped in with another category, but I would have thought that leukotriene modifiers would have had their own category. And then the other question I had was on slide 27, and this was the slide that had to do with asthma resource use by type of service versus overall mean by region. And the only question I had here had to do with the unclassified category. And the reason why I have a question is because there was a lot of variability between the regions, from 0.13 up to 1.53. And I wondered what was included in unclassified that would be so variable across the regions, and I just wondered if maybe that should be probed a little bit further and or explained a little bit more as to what was included in unclassified. In terms of now moving on to, under the analytic methods, I defer to the statistician. It all seemed to be adequate. The only thing that I bring up that I brought up earlier was the differences between the two data sets, the market scan and the WHIO data sets. In terms of the testing results, those seemed adequate, and I defer to the statistician, and the finding statement also seemed to be adequate. So that's it for 2A2. And then on 2B2, which is validity testing, demonstrates that the measured data elements are correct and that the measure score correctly reflects the cost of care or resources provided. It adequately distinguishes higher and lower cost or resource use. And my comments in terms of the data and the sample are the same as I previously described. And I thought the face validity was reasonable, that the analytic method seemed to be fine. The testing results, I agree with the summary provided by ABMS. And the finding statement, I also agree by the statement provided by ABMS. So that's it for 2B2. And then the next one was...
Kat, should I do the B1
2B3.
And B3 under validity?
Right. Sorry, didn't mean to skip.
Just to sort of do in order. So,
yeah, sorry.
So 2B1, to me, this issue of is it really measuring what you want it to brings up what I think is one of the critical issues, which is the necessity to define what are asthma-related costs and the arbitrariness, and I think in some cases the not correctness of some of those decisions. Bronchiolitis, for example, is, I don't think, asthma. Reflux is obviously can be related to asthma, but I would question it as an asthma cost, although it's not that I don't see where that comes from. So, and in drug costs, antibiotics obviously get used for a lot of things other than asthma. So I think it's a problem to try to determine what's an asthma-related cost and what's not, and I see that as an issue under does the measure really go after what you want it to. So that was my major concern about 2B1. Also, there's on page 12 of the measure copy that we saw where they were listing chronic oral steroids, the medicines there are mostly inhaled steroids, so that's just sort of a typo thing. But that was my concern with 2B1. And again, I don't know whether do we want to have any other comments from the panel or just sort of put it on the list to be responded to.
Does anybody have any other comments on these?
Actually, the Zab is here. Some of those antibiotics, but those are the real-life stuff that it's used, although antibiotics may not have much in a practical sense, but in real life, a fair number of physicians, perhaps unjustified, but they do use, and that does add to real costs. So the question is it really fair or unfair to include those kind of costs that they are not evidence-based, but it's just done?
It's not that antibiotics aren't used for it. I'm concerned that they're used for a lot of other things, and depending on a given health plan's other medical problems, antibiotic use could be being used differently in different plans.
Sure.
Yeah, this is Richard Stanford. I think from a claims perspective, it's difficult to determine exactly what these medications are used for. One way, if you want to continue to use it, is to try to link it to some kind of asthma-related office visit, for instance,
mm-hmm.
or asthma-related procedure, like the office visit for asthma and there was a procedure in that office visit for an asthma, quote-unquote, exacerbation or treatment. And then subsequently, the patient got a prescription for an antibiotic. I think that, you know, if you want to conclude it, you're going to have to attribute it to an asthma event.
Yeah, agreed. This is Kurt. I agree that would be very powerful because, in fact, you know, if we're looking at what's appropriate resource use and not, having a huge number of people with asthma placed on antibiotics is a very, very important finding. It would be a good opportunity to improve care if it could be related to the actual visit.
Now might be a good time, do you think, to have ABMS respond to some of these questions?
Yeah, I think there are unless other people feel otherwise, I think there are enough now that we could address these and clarify them at this point. Is that okay with you, Kevin?
That sounds fine. I'd be more than pleased, and I thank you. Those were very thoughtful comments and very helpful. Just to kind of give you an overview to kind of give you perspective on the project, we were seeking, of course, to look at how to understand variations in cost associated with certain conditions, and you'll be looking at some of those conditions today. And to do that, we used the episode framework, of course, that was promoted by NQF. In doing that, this is a distinction it's relatively different to us, probably not so much to you, is we did this under the ABMS Research and Education Foundation. And so I'm just saying about ABMS REF, and I don't want you to get confused, but these are not ABMS per se activities. These are the foundation activities that are distinct. And it's important because there's a lot of doctors out there who probably are wondering, is this something that's going to turn into magnitude of case or certification activities real soon? And the answer is foundation work doesn't directly relate to ABMS on a one-for-one basis. So I want to put that little bit in play. The second is that most of our work, as you'll see, was validated on a single database, which has been a problem across other measures. And you've identified a couple of those which relate back to the market scan data. While it is a very big and robust data set, and that's what it shows, it is a first and foremost a commercial data set, so it doesn't give us much insight into the Medicare population, and it gives us very little insight into the Medicaid population, so we have to be very careful about how we The other part to the market scan data that your one or two of the questions relate to is what happens to the sample when we start beginning to apply our inclusion-exclusion criteria. And the most important criteria that you start with, of course, is this continuity to make sure that they've been in the plan long enough. Then you want to make sure that you have a medication, which is important, because for asthma, if you're not getting some sort of medication, you really are going to be missing in just about all of the individuals, of course. We lose a lot of data that way in the market stand data because of the beneficiary issues. Most of the medication in the market scan data may be captured, but it's captured through third-party payers, which aren't attached to the market scan data. So you would see a very different look at the data set, for example, in a health plan that looked like Kaiser or a large multi-medical specialty plan that actually had access to the medication data. And so that's an important feature. There's also, when it gets down to the provider level, because market scan is designed not to be specifically a provider database, it's a database where it is not as precise. Yeah, and I shouldn't say precise because where the information is there, it's very good. It's just it's not inclusive of a very focused issue on provider ID. And so when it gets down to provider, and we lose.
Hello?
Yeah, we lost him.
Hello? What happened? Hello? Okay.
Kevin, are you there?
Okay, you may have lost him. Anyone else from ABMS could continue for him until he gets back?
Sure. This is Todd Lee. I can try to channel what Kevin was thinking.
Yeah,
thanks, Todd.
He was going to go down, I think, the route of where we get to try to – where we're – trying to attribute care to individual providers. And we, again, as was noted in the review and by the statistician, we lose a large proportion of our cohort because we don't have provider IDs on all of the visits we'd like to use when trying to test our attribution model. And again, this becomes a function of the data set that we're using. And it's not, you know, unique to the MarketScan data set. Lots of data sets have this limitation. And we realize that given that we've only done this in one data set, this approach does require some additional testing.
And just to note, Kevin Weiss, I apologize. You all suffered this consequence of the iPhone signal problem. But it sounds like Todd's taken over. I'll let him continue since I'm just about at my office and I can get off this iPhone. So, Todd, you're there to continue on?
Yeah, I can. Again, I was attempting to think about where I believed you were going around provider attribution and what we have in the data. And so, again, we realize that we need to do further testing around our methodology for this outside of a single MarketScan data set. We have done this, as was noted in the WEO data, for our asthma measure and for our diabetes measure, which you all are not reviewing. And it performs similarly, but we run into some of the same issues in terms of our ability to identify individual providers because of missing provider identifiers that are consistent within the data set. So that's sort of the overview, I think, that Kevin would have probably stopped at. And I can try and address some of the specific questions. I'll start with the inpatient cost one. These are all the ICD-9 codes that showed up during an inpatient event. We rely on primary diagnosis codes to identify asthma-related inpatient admissions. These just happen to be sort of the full spectrum of ICD-9 codes that show up across the episode measure. So all of the inpatient admissions have an asthma diagnosis associated with them. Have an ICD-9 code for an asthma-related service. And I think we heard Michael raise some concerns about some of the diagnosis codes that our work group decided to include as part of our measure. The other issue that I can talk about briefly, I think that was touched on, was around the medications. And both biologics and leukotrienes are included. If you actually would have gone to the next slide, let's see if I can find it relatively quickly. So slide 19, where it breaks it down by generic name, you can see montelukast is actually the second most attributable to the second highest level of cost in our episode, and omalizumab is number four.
Okay, and I did see that, Todd. That's probably why I was cued to look for the therapeutic class.
Unfortunately, I think the leukotrienes fall into the 234 unclassified agents. We probably should have done a better job of moving some of these medications around into more appropriate classes. Let's see, what was the other thing that was – oh, antibiotics. Our work group wrestled with this one quite a while, and it was for the reason of trying to capture some inappropriate care associated with antibiotic use among patients with asthma. We realize it's going to definitely introduce some noise if somebody's coming in and getting treated for a cellulitis and it's not related to an asthma exacerbation. We did not take the link that Richard suggested in tying antibiotic use to a diagnostic event, a physician visit, or a hospitalization. We have not done that as part of this episode. And my memory is quickly running out of gas. I don't remember what are the other sort of major issues that you all asked us to address. But I'll stop and react to any additional questions you might have or comments.
Great. Thank you, Todd. Does anybody have any questions? We might move on if there aren't any responses to that. Maybe we'll move on to the risk adjustment, 2B4.
Did we do 2B3? I'm sorry, Mike.
Right, yes. 2B3, I guess in terms of exclusions, I guess I wasn't totally sure why eosinophilic, I mean, just a couple of very specifics. I wasn't sure why eosinophilic esophagitis was excluded. And if difficult-to-treat asthma was to be excluded, which I think it was, then one might wonder about excluding Xolair. Um, but But other than that, it certainly seemed like the reasons were not unreasonable. Although, and I'm trying to remember now about the statistical review. But as I say, relative to the exclusions, there were just a couple that I wondered about.
All right. Are we ready to go to 2B4?
I think so. That sounds good.
Okay. 2B4 was for outcome measures and other measures, was there an evidence-based risk adjustment strategy? Was it specified, and is it based on patient clinical factors that influence the measured outcomes? That's basically it. So in terms of what they describe in their risk adjustment method, they talk about 12 different models, and they said C-table asthma RA1, which I couldn't find in any of the materials that were provided. So I don't know what that table had in it. Then they also talked about that the models were developed in a split sample approach with 75% of the population randomly selected for model development and the remaining 25% used for the model evaluation. So I wasn't sure what that 75% of the population was. Was it that 23% of the, was it that 50-something percent of the population that was available for from market scan, or was it something else? And I also wasn't sure what they meant by the full cohort. So since those weren't described, it made it difficult to know if this was an appropriate means to do so. But aside from that, the risk adjustment models appeared to be appropriate. And then in terms of their stratification method, they age stratified by 5 to 12 years, 13 to 51 years and 51 and older, and that seemed basically appropriate. And then the next section is 2B5. 2B5 has to do with data analysis demonstrates that methods for scoring and analysis of the specified measure allow for identification of statistically significant and practically and clinical meaningful differences. And their type of score, they used a ratio score, which I think is meaningful and appropriate. It makes it easy to visualize differences between groups. Their interpretation was meaningful and appropriate, but again, I'll defer to the statistician assessment on that. They used percentiles for some of their scoring, which was also easy and makes sense to understand. And the last part is describe the discriminating results approach, and that also appeared to be meaningful and appropriate. So that's it for me on 2B5.
And I think 2B6, the general issue is there aren't multiple data sources, I don't think, since this is all administrative data, so that's not applicable. And 2C, we don't, I think, have the information to say too much about that, which has been true, of course, with many of the measures.
Right. Right. We're not discussing 2B6 or 2C. Does anybody have any other comments on the risk adjustment? Great. Well, I think that was really helpful. Shall we move on to the next measure now?
Yeah, that is the stable chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, correct?
Correct. That's 1581, stable chronic. And we have Doreen and Richard and Curtis leading that discussion.
And it looks like, Curtis, you're the first one with 2A1.
Curtis, are you there?
Yeah, now that I'm not on mute, I was there in spirit at least. now I'm in there. And I'm not even dealing with an iPhone, so we're lucky to have had iTod also. What I was going to say is that I'll try to. I think the comments across the board are somewhat similar, so I'll try to focus on things that might be different. I think 2A1 is very similar to what we already talked. I think the talked about the logic of well described construction is very well described. They deal with the risk adjustment methodology, and the clinical logic is done well. Again, the standard prices I think are there. I think some of this still. I'd like a little more information on how they decide to include the various diagnoses and the and which medications they would use. And it's, again, it goes back to whether or not you can. With COPD, there's so patients in general. There may be a lot of other things going on, and how do we adjust? For example, the diabetic who has cellulitis versus a flare of the COPD, and how we can adjust for that. I think the again the data sources seem to be the same. So the issues are there also, and I think the same issue, in general, the same issues are there that were for asthma also.
Any other comments on 2A1?
This is Doreen. The only thing I would add is I would like to see on page 11 in the list of the several procedure codes. I appreciate back on the procedure codes, which are on page 14. They do include pulmonary rehab, but they don't state it here. I understand that this is a data set of commercial insurance of administrative data, but since CMS approved a national coverage determination January of 2010, I think we're going to see more commercial insurances actually covering pulmonary rehab, and I think that needs to be at least equivalent to all the other procedures in the discussion as everything else, because this is an important part of the care of these patients.
Thanks, Jim.
Any other comments on that one? Oh, Richard, do you want to do 2A2?
Yes, and it's regarding the reliability testing, and I think some of these issues were brought up earlier around the data set that was chosen. You know, MarketScan is an employer-based data set, which means that patients are put in by employees, and to that point, I think all the things we talked about earlier around Medicaid, Medicare, don't really apply to this measure. I think it was done very well in terms of what was available to the group, but other than that, it was I rated it actually high for liability testing. Just the fact that MarketScan is probably not the most best. Well, there is not really a best data set, but it's not conducive to looking at other populations outside of employed population. The other, I'm looking at my notes here. The other things that's around, I think still in 2A2, is around. I think that they did an excellent job, and I'm just going down the list here. I think they did an excellent job of stratification. I'm not quite to the risk adjustment models yet, but we can talk about that if you like. I'm not sure if I'm on 2A2 or 2B2, so I think 2A2 is just mainly around the reliability testing.
Yeah. So why don't we go to 2B1 then, Kurt?
Yeah, this is Kurt. I think there were I'd like more information on the how we would determine variations, I think the risk adjustment. I wasn't sure that there was enough information on how you would do the risk adjustments for this, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. So that'd be my major the major issues. I don't know whether this pertains now, but I'm looking at the. I think it's in the 1581 final PDF. And looking at COPD-related procedures, I was a little bit confused how things like nasal endoscopy and polypectomy wound up in there. As opposed to other things that might, and chemotherapy administration, whether those were just what you saw from the I just want to make sure I'm understanding that, whether you were going to include those or whether that was just what you were seeing when you looked at the Thompson looked at the database as it included costs. How should we, I think that was on slide 9.
ABMS, do you want to just specifically comment on that, because that's a specific question?
Sure. Procedures get into this slide or this table when there is one of two ways. They're a specific procedure listed in our specification for the episode, which the work group identified several of them that are COPD-related, independent of any diagnostic code that shows up. The other ones enter into this table if there is a COPD diagnosis code associated with that procedure. And again, we know we're going to include some things that may or may not be incredibly specific to COPD, but it has a COPD diagnosis on that claim or a diagnosis that our work group identified as potentially being related to COPD, and that's how procedures end up on this table. This was an iterative process where we would produce this table over and over again until the work group was comfortable saying, okay, I think we've got a good approximation of resource use that might be associated with the care for a patient that has COPD.
Thank you. Any other comments on 2B1? Richard, do you want to do 2B2?
Yeah, I'm trying to find out where that is. 2B2 was validity, is that correct?
Validity, yeah, correct.
I guess that my question, maybe it's not part of this, is that I think I read in this document where you did not impute zero values. Is that right, Todd?
That's correct.
And why did you take that tact of not imputing zero values?
Because we didn't know if the quantity was zero. Sorry, if the quantity was missing, we imputed a one. If the quantity was zero, we just excluded that as a line item.
You mean quantity? I'm talking about what if the cost was zero?
Oh, we imputed a cost for everything.
I misinterpreted that. Okay, good. That makes a lot more sense then. I misinterpreted. I thought you didn't impute zero cost.
No, every procedure code that occurs in the data set has a standardized cost associated with it.
So if one did not show up, you imputed it.
Well, if it showed up and it had zero associated and only showed up once, I think it would get a zero. I'd have to go back and see specifically what we did with those claims. And I don't even know if there was any occurrence of that happening.
Okay. But if let's say health plan was using your method and they had a zero cost, your method would be impute that cost.
Correct. They should – every procedure – everything that happens should have a standardized cost associated with it.
Okay.
Because it's not free.
No, I understand. I wasn't sure about whether. Okay. I just misinterpreted that.
Okay.
So from a validity perspective, I gave it a high ranking. I thought they did a nice job of trying to determine that validity measurement and the overall score. I don't have any questions around that. I thought they did an excellent job.
Great, thanks. Kurt or anyone else, any other comments around validity? Okay, Kurt, you're 2B3.
Yeah, 2B3. I think they're similar, as we've said before. I don't think there's a lot of new. They did evaluate the effect of exclusions on sample size. I didn't see notes about the effect of the distribution on any outcomes. Similarly, they did there are data completeness related exclusions, both are addressed. I wasn't, as I think our statistician also addressed the, I'm not sure I saw clarity on the implications of the large percent of missing provider IDs, and I think Kevin's addressed that. And I'd be interested to know how you would plan on addressing that issue as it would be moved out into a resource utilization measure, and how confident you are, or what measures, what kind of
Todd or Kevin, do you want to comment on that?
If Kevin's on, I'll let him take those.
I don't think he's there.
I just got on, but I just got on. So if you could give me the short version of that, I'll take it.
Okay. How?
Go ahead.
Kevin, the question is how will it be addressed, the issue of lack of provider identifiers and the impact it has on attribution as these measures might go forward?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. It's not a question about our measure. It's a question about the issue of provider identification, which is more generic. Pretty clearly, the data set we were working with was not designed for that function. And in fact, if we're working at the health plan level rather than the health plan aggregate that MarketScan worked at in this particular data set, we would be able to have gotten a much better physician attribution. My guess from seeing some of the work that's been done in the field by health plans who can do this because they actually have the data, they can get up to about 85%+ of attribution. But there will still be a residual. And how does one manage that residual? Well, it becomes a question of whether or not it's a random or a non-random event in terms of why a physician's provider ID is missing. So I think it's a generic question, unless you all see it differently. Is that a response that feels true in your thoughts as a committee?
Yeah, I would think that using de-identified data such as MarketScan, you won't be able to get at that data, but a health plan should be able to get at that level.
Correct. Yeah. That's exactly it.
Yeah, we
that's actually true. I work for a health plan, and they can get at that level. But in order to, keep testing your data, do you have access to any database where you can get better attribution? Because that seems to be a problem across all of the, not just our measures, but the cardiac measures and everything.
I agree.
So we have had interest from some health plans that would allow us to do this. We just had to be mindful of when the date for submission was there. We just had to deliver what we had. We are in the process right now of doing some field testing. We're doing field testing on some community-based data sets, so they're going to be a weaker in terms of attribution, at least physician ID, than they would be if they were at the plan level. However, within those communities, there are some that actually have plans that will probably drill down directly. So we will be getting that data. It just wasn't in time for the submission of this particular application.
Okay, thanks. That's good.
Thank you.
2B4, I think, Richard?
Risk adjustment strategy. Let me just say I really commend the group for using some non-linear types of analysis. I was really impressed by the ability to look at different distributions and using some log link functions. I thought that was excellently done. I don't think anybody else has actually done that. And from a econometric perspective, I think that's the way it should be done. I'm not talking about the usability part of it. However, I wonder how easily that can be replicated in a health plan. So I think the risk adjustment strategy is great. I don't have a problem with what they did. As a matter of fact, I think they actually went beyond what normally is done, really around adjusting not only the population severity, but adjusting the variance that you see within the cost parameters. I thought that was well done. However, you know, I wonder how well people outside of, you know, the high statistical levels can actually do that from a plan perspective. That's just a question.
Yeah. You want to comment on that, Todd or Kevin?
Todd, do you want to take that?
Sure. It's a great question, Richard, and one we wrestled with a lot. Knowing that we wanted to do as good a job as we could of adjusting for differences within case mix of the population, and then at the same time trying to balance that with usability and implementing episode within different contexts. And because of that, we say, you know, you can go through this same exercise that we've gone through, testing all these different models, seeing which one sort of fits best when you do it on 75% and then use a 25% validation sample. Or you can use our equation. Now, we know that we need to evaluate these procedures, and that's something that's going to be important in the next sort of phase of testing of these episodes is can health plans, other users of our episodes, implement our risk adjustment strategies. And if they choose to basically use the beta coefficient weights that we've provided, does that do an adequate job outside of the market scan data? Again, something that needs further testing.
Yeah, and I think in doing that, you can also come up with a minimum sample that's needed for that as well, which you don't have that in here, which is fine. But I think after you continually test this, you should be able to come up with those numbers.
Yeah, we've heard a lot in the review of our episode that our measures that we've submitted around the sample size, and we have not discussed sample size anywhere. You know, we can generate sample size estimates in market scan based on what we found, but again, we don't know about the generalizability of those estimates, and you know, choosing what's a minimally important difference becomes somewhat arbitrary. So we need some further testing around all of these issues.
Great, thanks. Do you want to do 2B5, Richard?
2B5. Yeah, I thought they did the analytical and data analysis plans were excellent, and the scoring methods were right on. I don't have any problems or really comments around what was done.
2B6, Richard?
Yeah, I think the same issue.
Actually, that's the last one for science.
2B5, okay. All right.
Okay, great.
And that's perfect. It's just in time.
Any other comments at all around the stable COPD measure? Nope. Do we move on?
Yep, Laura? That sounds perfect. Yep, the next one is 1582, which is unstable COPD.
Okay.
Just a note to the committee with apologies. When this was scheduled, I had a direct conflict that I couldn't move more than an hour. So I think Todd, you'll still be on, and Robin Wagner, and Larry Mannheim, who
I'm on.
Oh, wonderful, Larry. I'll be kind of quietly stepping off in 5 minutes unless the committee has any questions that they would like from me, which I don't know if that would be important in our. Great. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, 1582, unstable chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Zab, you have the first one, 2A1.
Sure. I guess some of the issues, I mean, a lot of data, the important data, obviously, it's been spelled out fairly in detail. One of the major challenges that I have is that separation of stable versus unstable, and that demarcation point gets fuzzy. And the fact that obviously this hasn't been tested, that's the challenge. But in terms of having the information, as information is there, is just as deciphering it, where it falls is the challenge. So that's one of my major understanding of the logic of it, and I understand that that's the real life issue. It's not necessarily criticism of the proposal, but it's just these are very, very challenging issues that where the stability ends and where unstable condition begins. So that's my comment on that.
Thanks, Zab. I actually also this was one of the measures I reviewed, and I guess I agree exactly with what Zab said, but it was maybe with a little more detail. It wasn't it clear to me how you chose exactly the criteria for unstable disease, and it's interesting. I didn't see it really documented in the literature why those specific parameters were chosen. And as it turned out, the parameters were focused around one, oxygen use, that was one. Another one was severe hospitalization, which has got some specific parameters to it, and then LVRS. And as it turned out, when you went to test it in your database, these separated out into very separate groups of people. And so you ended up with what seemed to me to be like three separate measures, and there weren't even any LVRSs in the database. So my question would be, I wonder if there's some room to go back and kind of refine what creates an unstable COPD patient, because I think that the way it's defined now, you might be missing a big group of people who really are kind of unstable and costly but don't fit into these groups. Is that... Do you want to comment on that? Or
sure. Yeah. No. I think it's spot on. The comments are spot on regarding the demarcating line between what we call stable and unstable. You know, we actually tried to go down more severe, less severe disease, but knowing we can't measure lung function and have clinical measures of disease severity, we opted for this unstable, stable definition, and it does have a lot of grayness in that line that we've drawn to differentiate our populations. All of this has a huge limitation in that this is a relatively younger data set. So we realized that for measures like COPD, given the age distribution of patients with COPD, you know, we need to test this in older populations. We need to test this in Medicare. We need to test this in other data sets that have people that are 65 and older, given that they're the preponderance of patients with the disease. So it's hard to say whether or not we've drawn the right line right now. You know, like you noted, the home oxygen users were really the majority of the people that got into the sort of more severe, unstable cohort, and I don't know what that would look like if we did it in, you know, an older population. So I think there is room to continue to evaluate how we've drawn this line around stability, if you will.
Okay, thanks. Any other comments on that one? 2A2 is mine, and that was reliability testing, and I think it was Todd that just answered that. Basically, the issue is that this is a disease of older people, and it was tested in an under 65 database. That would be my main comment about the reliability. 2B1, or did you have any comments about that, Zab or others?
Well, I mean, it's the same issue. The data is bit grainy, and it's there's a lot of data. There's a lot of data. You can, this could be, you know, you close your eyes and you could say congestive heart failure. It's right here, and I understand it's not an easy challenge. The definition of COPD, unstable COPD, is very challenging. Particularly the age issue becomes a very, I would advocate the idea that it's okay to have a broader age range because the COPDers are getting younger and younger now. But at the same time, there's something inherent about Medicare population in terms of the exacerbation, hospital admissions, and medication use, handheld devices versus meter dose inhaler and so on. So this data looks at a fairly narrow population, and I'm not all that sure that if it's tested at a different population, the same conclusions can be reached.
Okay, great. 2B1.
This is Michael. From a person who doesn't really take care of COPD, as I'm hearing this discussion, I guess I'm a little confused as to why it's necessary to even define two groups as opposed to just looking at the cost of COPD, which would include exacerbations.
That's an important point, Michael. That's because this is a continuum of disease, and exacerbation is, you know, on average, COPDers have 1.5 to 2.5 exacerbation per year, but that's exacerbation or instability is just a part of the disease, perhaps bulk of the cost actually to throughout the year, this cost continues. It's an episode, basically.
Yeah, I think that the instability here in terms of hospitalizations is not just a COPD hospitalization or even outpatient visit. It's a very severe exacerbation. So I don't think it's covered the whole area of stable, at home, get an exacerbation, get a management, go home with a 2 or 3 day hospitalization or no hospitalization. It's extremes of the spectrum, not the bulk of patients. I don't know. Would you agree with that, Zab?
That's fair. It's just picks up the different pockets of the spectrum of the disease. You know, from a little bit from the rehab, a little bit oxygen use, a little bit admissions, and but the disease, it's one disease that goes through these cycles, and these cycles, one day is there's a baseline utilization of resources, and there's these periodic episodes, and to pick these episodes becomes very fuzzy.
Okay.
I was just wondering, one question I guess in my mind is, how do you parse that out from cardiovascular disease, which is a common kind of comorbidity for these admissions?
It becomes impossible.
Yeah.
Someone misses.
That's just one, you know, one thing to consider in this. And then, well, you know, again, when you measure the cost, then that's really part of maybe a significant portion of these patients.
Well, do you need to parse it out, though? I mean, that might be the really underlying question. I mean, they become intertwined.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, someone misses the diuretics for 3 days, and then they catch a flu, they get exacerbation. So what is this, infection, pneumonia, is this CHF or COPD exacerbation? And all three, they increase the healthcare, you know, resources they use.
Okay, we kind of covered 2B1, did we, Zab? Do you have anything else on that?
No,
nothing.
No.
Okay. 2B2 is validity testing. We also kind of talked about that, I think, but I thought it might be useful to just give the example in this population, the market scan population. They started out with 252,000 people who met the inclusion criteria for COPD. When they got done with the enrollment stuff, they ended up, you know, discontinuity and so on, they ended up with 108. And by the time they actually got to people they could test with all the other exclusions and so on, they had 42,319, of which only 11% were on stable during the measurement year. So of their final population, they had 4,655 who could be looked at with this measure. And of those, I think 92% only met the oxygen criteria. So to look at the severe hospitalization criteria, they had 372 people. So that's a tiny number compared to what we started out with. And they only had a 50% attribution rate, so 43% of episodes, I don't know if they were, you know, randomly distributed through the severe hospitalization group, but only 43% of these could actually be attributed to specific physicians. And this is a physician attribution measure. It's not a hospital attribution measure. With that kind of numbers, I'm not sure if this is valuable to use, because it seems like you have so few episodes in this severe hospitalization group that, you know, you're not going to really reflect what the resource use of different physicians is, because many of them won't even have one of these attributed to them. So I don't know if that's important or not, but I thought that might be a problem. And this goes back to, you know, picking your criteria and so on. Any comments about that?
Do you want us to respond? Or
sure.
Me to respond?
Sure.
I mean, my best response is you're absolutely right. And I think it goes to the point that I made earlier that we realize, especially for this sort of quote-unquote unstable population, that this is probably not the ideal data set to be testing this COPD measure in, and we need to further evaluate our definitions around sort of instability. And I should note that stable and unstable does not sort of define people who exacerbate and do not exacerbate. People in the quote-unquote unstable group have exacerbations. They have hospitalizations. They don't just have these really intense hospitalizations where they're in for 10 days, and they're not using long-term oxygen. So that's really the differentiating line. And, again, we were trying to get at disease severity more than anything else.
Other comments? 2B3.
I guess the exclusions. Again, I think, as you pointed out, Janet, there's a lot of people been excluded, but I'm not sure that, again, that the criteria that you exclude, you know, when you drop down from 200,000 to a very, very small number, you probably miss out. Some people just drop out, especially since these are not really, you're defining severe exacerbation. This is just a little worse than stable, being unstable. They may have actually excluded too many people. I'm not sure, because the initial denominator is just massive, and presumably all of those have some, they fulfill the definition of COPD, but then it is surprising to me that it just such a smaller number. So I think, as Todd mentioned, maybe this is not the right population. I mean, this has to be really tested in the field to see if these are really applicable. So I had some concerns about these exclusions.
It needs to be tested in Medicare population, I believe, as has already been mentioned, because that's the population that has the most of these patients in it. Any other comments on 2B3? So 2B4 is risk adjustment, and this was the same risk adjustment general approach that's been discussed before, and I don't think I have anything more to comment on that. There was just a couple comments. So when there is a I think people get excluded if they have a hospice claim in the last 6 months, which I hadn't seen on other of the measures, and I just wanted to mention that, which I thought was a good thing. What was interesting is when they reported their results, they found such huge differences in the costs of these different groups that they identified, the oxygen use group versus the severe hospitalization group, that they actually stratified them by those two different groups. So it was like the cost per year for somebody who'd been on oxygen for 2 months, which was the inclusion criteria, was like $14,000, and for severe hospitalization was more like $45,000. So in the end, ABMS just sort of stratified them that way, which was kind of interesting. Any comments on that, Todd?
We essentially, self-fulfill our own prophecy with this severe hospitalization definition. Those were going to be very, very high-cost, high-resource-use patients, and when we really looked at the data, it became clear that it wouldn't be – equitable to lump those with the 2 months sort of chronic home oxygen users. They were different groups. And so, again, we're doing this based on really small numbers, so this is, again, something that we need to further evaluate. And all of this discussion has been very helpful to us and probably gives you a sense to realize some of the other comments that we've heard that led us to sort of pull back on our measures and know that we need to do some further testing. So this has been really valuable to us, so thank you.
You are most welcome. 2B5, we didn't do that one, right, Lorelei?
Yes, 2B5 is significant differences identified. But you haven't talked about it yet, no?
Yeah, no, I didn't have any comments of that. This is the observed to expected approach, and it's not been tested in a population yet. I think there are funds to test these in populations, and that's ongoing, but there are nothing reported. Any other comments about that?
No.
So I think that's all for the unstable, correct?
Yep, that's correct. Perfect. So I think if nobody has comments on that one, then we can move right along to 1587, which is ambulatory pneumonia. And
I can take that.
And remind you, it was Kurt and Dale and Jab who were assigned to that measure.
Yeah, I can take that. I'll start off with, I think, just to move us along, since it's we still have some other things to go through with the usability issues. I think the 2A1 is, I don't have anything new for that. I think they're the same issues overall. I think the the excluded people with in terms of measure construction logic, I think that made sense. Although there, as our reviewer also noted, there seems to be insufficient detail of the risk adjustment model, which we can talk about later on. There are 12 models that are tested, and the functional form of each model are divided into three groups, but we didn't get a lot of it. We could use more information as to what the variables in each groups were. The data derivation process was well done. I think the data elements are well defined. Again, we'll need to talk about the risk adjustment later on. But that's all I have for 2A1. That would be, it's really the same. Dale, can you take 2A2?
Yeah. So, again, the issues here are not much different than have been discussed before. It's been tested in the MarketScan commercial database. So this is ambulatory pneumonia. And while pneumonia tends to be, again, a disease of the elderly, and probably, you know, we missed two-thirds of the cases by focusing on this commercial data set, there are clearly a substantial number of cases of pneumonia in this age group. With respect to reliability testing, I didn't have any questions about the actual reliability testing itself, other than the fact that it's been tested primarily in the commercial population. I seem to have lost my notes here. I had a couple of other questions about, I think the developers did a good job of trying to create a data set that focused on truly community-acquired pneumonia. That's challenging, however. So when you look through the data set that was used, they exclude nursing home patients, hospice patients, and kind of the standard and recently hospitalized patients. So those are all standard exclusions for the community-acquired population. And then in their high-cost condition exclusions, they excluded patients that were on end-stage renal disease, organ transplants, cancer patients, and that probably gets rid of the bulk of patients who are immunocompromised. But there are possibilities that some patients get into the data set that would typically meet a definition of healthcare-associated pneumonia. So that would be other patients on immunosuppressive therapy that aren't excluded from the data set, patients who may be on outpatient infusion therapy with antibiotics. Chronic wound care patients is another category that's typically considered healthcare associated, and I don't see, at least in the high cost conditions or others, that those patients are excluded. So there may be a few. I think they've done a fairly good job of excluding non-community acquired pneumonia cases, but there may be a few HAPs that get into the data set. Really, those are my primary comments.
Okay. Thank you. I'll take 2B3. Again, similar. I don't think there's much new in here. We just, like you said, the effective exclusions on sample size were evaluated. I think that overall they were well developed. I just think the way that it's currently developed, it's going to be difficult to evaluate the effect on distribution of outcome. And I think that also goes back to whether or not you can identify individual providers in the database that you've used. As we've discussed, when you put it into other populations, you'll probably be able to do that. I don't think that there are. I don't think there's anything significantly different than the other items we've mentioned.
And I'll carry on with 2B2, and again, I don't have too much to add. I had just a general comment about, so in a moment we're going to talk about the inpatient pneumonia. So when you look at all of the rationale that was provided in the important section, I know we're not talking about that, but all of the rationale around variations in care, the entire literature that was quoted focused on inpatient care, and that's where all the literature is on real variations in care and outcomes for pneumonia. The reality is, for ambulatory pneumonia, the mortality rate is exceptionally low, so when I was thinking and looking at validity testing, I'm sure that there are differences in resource use, and I think that the measure probably does provide some valid comparisons on resource use. How that actually then links in any way to patient outcomes is unclear to me. Because if we're thinking about these measures from the standpoint of pure resources and also then thinking about value, getting reasonable quality at the best cost, because the outcomes for ambulatory pneumonia are universally good for the vast majority of patients, it becomes a bit more difficult to tell how useful this measure will be. I think it'll be useful in terms of looking at some of the resource use issues, and frankly, I've been digging through this data to see what the actual variations in cost were across episodes or providers. I'm sure there are variations. How that links to actual differences in outcomes, I think that'll be kind of this whole issue of face validity with clinicians about, how important it is.
Thank you. Any questions? Any other comments on that? Okay. Then 2B6. I think you've addressed 2B5. Do you have any, Dale?
I think pretty much. I mean, in general, I like the construct of the measure. I think there are some questions about the denominator, and then there's well known variations in care in the inpatient setting. And outcomes in the inpatient setting. In the outpatient setting, I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I agree. It's a mess, particularly because, some people will provide, we'll call it like a pneumonitis and pneumonia, which will markedly decrease your mortality right there, as well as your overall cost. And I don't know how widespread this is, but I know one insurer in our area specifically sent a letter to us providers telling us if we had we're thinking about the diagnosis of bronchitis to think about another diagnosis if we're going to use antibiotics so they wouldn't look so bad. It's pretty I mean, they phrased it very nicely, but the bottom line was they wanted us to create some other diagnosis code so they wouldn't look bad. But I think it's an area that that really is important to address. I did want to really compliment the ABMS on the, you know, I think you've done a lot of very very innovative thinking in this to try to get around some stuff that's very difficult, and you know, try to get out of just, you know, saying here's the claims data and here's the best we can do. I think that your approach, I want to encourage you on what you've done, because I think there's a lot of potential here. You know, in finishing this off, though, in terms of 2B6, I think everything's the same as it was. I think the, you know, it just depends on using a different database. We really don't know whether there'll be comparable results, and I think that applies to a lot of other submissions. And the, I think you're, how would you see this in terms of looking at, in terms of 2C, I'd like to know how you're thinking about addressing disparities of care. I mean, the criteria are that, you know, factors that identify groups based on race and socioeconomics that shouldn't be used as part of the risk adjustment methodology. I guess some people could argue with, actually. But how would you, if you were going to, as you're going through this, how does the ABMS see these measures being used to identify disparities in care, or as risk factors for such?
Well, unfortunately,
not that you have to, but I'm just wondering whether you, that was a.
Yeah, we are limited in our ability to do that because of the availability of socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity variables in the data set. You know, and until we have data sets that provide that information, we really, our hands are tied in terms of being able to even look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, you know, to look at that, you would look at that as a research question, and maybe, I mean, it's not, as a implementation, obviously, in some sense, you don't want to, certainly you don't want to stratify or anything else on that in the sense of saying, allowing differences, but you want to know what's happening. But it's very hard to think about how you should incorporate it or not incorporate it in implementing something other than be able to see whether there's a difference. But I think it's very hard to think about what the difference would mean. And given we didn't have the data, we didn't think about it very much.
Thank you. Okay. Other comments on 1587? For items two. So that leaves us with 1588, is that right?
Hey, Kurt, the point I'd make,
please.
I meant to, is the, again, you know, the 85% of the population is excluded from, or at least the initial, you know, the initial group of identified E&M codes, 85% of the population was excluded, and that may be quite appropriate, sample size will get much smaller at the individual provider level pretty quickly.
Agreed. That's a good point. Thanks, Jim. Any other comments on 1587? Okay. While we finish off with, go ahead, please. Any comments?
No, that's great. Shall we move along to
1588? Yeah.
I see that was Janet, Linus, and Dale.
So I can start this one as 2A1. This is the hospitalized, the community-acquired pneumonia hospitalized one, and this is attributed not at the provider level but at the hospital level because they found out as they started to do it that it was, there were so many doctors taking care of patients in the hospital that they couldn't really attribute. So I guess it's a little easier to do it this way. Again, I really only have one comment about the specifications, and I'm just a little curious about this. The episode that's described here starts up to 3 days before hospitalization and lasts for 30 days from the first day of hospitalization. And I looked to find the logic for doing that exactly, and it was, I think, just a decision that was made by the work group. And it's a little odd because of the way that hospitals report things. I understand that's probably, based on the 30-day mortality rate. But in terms of resource use, I wonder if the group considered using a 30-day readmission time period as the end of the resource use period, because that's kind of a standard way that the industry reports, resource use around that episode, and it would probably be a little easier for hospitals to work with. By that I mean that from the date of discharge, there would be a 30-day period that would be included in the episode. If you do it the way that it's designed now, and you have, like, you can have somebody that's hospitalized for 2 days or 3 days, and then they have what would kind of be, I guess, an outpatient period of maybe 28 days. Whereas if you get somebody who's really sick and they're in the ICU and they don't get discharged until 14 days, then your follow-up period would only be 14 days. And that's a pretty small time period to really capture all of the costs that might be associated with that episode. So maybe I'm missing some reason why the 30 days from day of admission was picked. But do you want to comment about that?
Okay, let me give a rationale, which I think went into the thinking, and that is, so if you're a hospital and you keep someone a day or two longer, because try and keep them out of the hospital later, then you're in a sense penalizing them by extending the period over which you're going to accumulate their costs because they did that. So I think the notion was that the time period should be the same in terms of comparing costs, and then within that period, people can look at that. But
So
I don't know whether that's a good rationale or not, and not being a...
No, I think that rationale makes sense. I guess, though, I'm not convinced that it... Well, so I understand what you're saying. I'm not sure it makes sense, though. So I think as people now are looking at the payment penalties associated with higher readmission rates, some hospitals are making the decision that in some cases it makes sense to keep the patient for an extra day or so to make sure that their care transitions are smoother and other things, so that social issues are addressed. But it seems that the extra cost attributed to the extra hospital day could be offset by the reduction in readmission. So I'm not sure the rationale that you just described makes sense from a cost standpoint.
And I guess my other point would be sort of the industry looks at 30-day readmission rates. It would make it probably easier for reporting by the hospitals if that could be. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking in terms of the
standardizing.
Right.
So I guess that was my main comment on that part. Are you handling this one, Kurt, or am I? I can do it. Linus,
yes.
You want to do 2A2?
So reliability testing. I think it might have been mentioned earlier as far as using the HEC and that being employed differently by the CMS and NCQA, using total cost as opposed to episode cost. I guess the question is how much is that cost attributable to inpatient hospital care for this particular method of analysis? So, I mean, as far as how repeatable that would be, it's more of a question really than not understanding that much how that's actually being used right now by, you know, or rather in practical terms being used for this particular measure?
Any comments on that?
I'm afraid. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Yeah, so the, I mean, it's kind of, you kind of written in there and says it recognizes it's a different, the HEC is being employed differently in this case as opposed to how CMS and the NCQA uses it.
Oh, right. It's being employed, you mean, for the episode rather than for total cost.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, true in all our measures. And I think because it's being used that way, you would expect some things that have very high effects on total costs might have almost no effect on episode costs. That's why we estimated it and went to some lengths at estimating it for all these different models. But basically, we didn't have something better to use. And so, you know, part of this was to actually see and construct what the effect was on episode costs. And part of what we did was we up front asked the work group to look at the comorbidities or conditions and say which ones they thought were relevant for the episodes. But in the end, we used that as one model, but we also put them all in and saw which had an effect alternatively. So we figured that was the best way that we could figure out how to do it.
Okay. Any other comments on that one? Uh, 2B1 is my specification validity. This one is similar to the outpatient one in that the measure specifiers were trying to get as pure a population as they could. And as Dale mentioned, on the ambulatory care, they excluded probably at least half of the healthcare-associated pneumonia-type patients, trying to get pure community-acquired pneumonia. It had the impact on their data of really reducing the data from by about 80% in terms of the number of cases that they were actually looking at. So I guess in my mind, there's a bit of a question about how important it is to get just community-acquired pneumonia versus healthcare-associated pneumonia. But, you know, I mean, given that the goal was to get community-acquired pneumonia in a pure sense, I think that they did that by fairly well by using their exclusions.
Yeah, and this is Dale. I'll just say the same comment. I mean, I think they did do a very good job of trying to get to the pure population, but there are clearly some HAPs that will slip through that just weren't excluded using the criteria, like the wound care patients, infusion patients, and some immunosuppressed patients that'll get in again, it's tough to get them all out of the denominator.
And now the other comment here, I guess, too, is that were this looked at in an over 65 population, you probably would have ended up with a much larger group to actually test in the end rather than in this database. Linus, you have 2B2?
Yeah, I think, well, one, maybe we could start with that, your last comment as far as the validity. In the sense that, comparison to other databases, I think, hasn't really been done. I guess, how would it perform? I mean, the process employed was described in the supplement, that it appears satisfactory, having been vetted to an advisory committee, but at the same time, there's no, its validity with other databases would, I guess, be the question, unless they think that, this is something that would really be just a use of the market scan, which limits it then, because as I understand it, the market scan doesn't have that much of older people, which, as you said, would be the main kind of population you'd be interested in this particular disease.
No one over 65.
Yeah, so I guess that's a really common theme across all of the ones that we've looked at here, except for asthma, is wouldn't it be nice to have an older database to check this in? Older age database.
Yeah.
2B3 is exclusions. I think I already addressed that, around the exclusions to make sure that the group really had a fairly pure cap population, and it's already been discussed. 2B4, Linus?
So, again, they are using the HEC for risk adjustment. I've raised some questions with that previously. But the other thing, I'm a little confused with how the modeling is supposed to be applied. They mentioned like 12 models being used, but it's unclear exactly, how do you decide then what of these models to use, or how exactly do you proceed from those 12 models?
Are you on, Todd?
Yep, I'm here. I can handle those. So that was all done in the developmental side. It's not expected that someone would use all 12 models. It was our evaluation of which of the 12 approaches seemed to do a better job from a risk adjustment standpoint. So we fit these 12 different models. We looked at all sorts of diagnostics, how well the 75% development sample fit the 25% validation sample in terms of observed to expected residuals. We showed all this to the work groups, and essentially we tried to, when we came down to similarly performing models, we picked the model that performed the best. If models performed similarly, we opted for the most parsimonious model and models that reported results in dollar values rather than logged dollar values. So that was all on the developmental side. And then we have this risk adjustment model that we have decided fits the best for this episode, and that's the model that you see in the submission form that has all the dollar values associated with certain conditions. And as I mentioned earlier, for COPD, we need to then test how well this fits external populations outside of the market scan data before we're willing to say that, this is the model that everyone should use.
Any other comments, Linus or others, on that?
No, not really. I guess that answers the question. I still have to try to comprehend how exactly that applies then when you actually do it, but I have two. Yeah.
Comment?
No, I was going to just say. I have two. I think I have 2B5 as well.
Yeah.
It's quite short, which is just to say that again, it's a market scan database that they used. So I think maybe allowing demonstration to reduce or to produce comparable results with other databases might be helpful.
I think that pretty much completes the comments that we have. Anyone else want to comment on any of these? I want to thank the ABMS people, all of you, for coming and helping us better understand these. And I think that we really like this set of measures overall because they're very clinical and really appeal to the physicians. And we really hope that you rework them a bit and come back with them because we'd love to see them in the resource use pool of measures.
Yeah.
Kurt, did you want to say?
I'd reiterate that, Janet. I think when I look through these, although you know, with we've given you a lot of comments today, these were the set of measures where I thought, gosh, this is really getting to something that's not only resource-based but clinically meaningful, and these guys get it. And so I really want to applaud you all enough for the hard work you've done and would love to see these back.
Well, thank you. I mean, we again really appreciate the input that you have given us, and I think we've heard it across all of our episodes that we need more work. I think we're on the right track, but we need further development to get them to the point where NQF and the advisory panels are willing to say, yeah, these are measures that are implementable and usable, and your willingness to review these even after we've withdrawn them is very helpful in moving that process forward. So we want to also thank you guys.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thanks. Great. Thank you. Thank you so
Thanks.
Much.
Okay.
Before we actually adjourn the call, I might just ask our operator, Anthony, if there are any members of the public on the line who would like to comment.
And public lines are open.
Anthony, can you tell if there's anybody there?
At the moment, it doesn't appear that there are any public members that are on, but all lines are currently open. So.
Okay, great.
Anybody's out there, we're glad to hear from you.
I don't think it sounds like there's nobody there. Well, I would like to say thank you on behalf of everybody at NQF for your hard work. You've been a great tap, and thank you to Janet and Curtis. Thank you so much for being wonderful co-chairs.
We greatly appreciate the excellent staffing you've done for this and made it tremendously easy for us for a very challenging job to go extremely smoothly. So thank you.
Oh, thank
you. I second that.
Thank you. Well, this is the last time I think that we'll actually be talking to you. I think maybe during the public feedback period. If we have any specific questions, we can come back to you. But this is it for now. So thank you. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.
As people are going, I wanted to make sure that Janet and I, if I both mentioned how fortunate we were to chair a committee with you all, with a great group of people that are on this, and it's proven to be exactly right. You've been incredibly helpful, and you know, your keen insights have really made a big difference in how successful we've been able to provide feedback.
Thank you.
Yes,
and
thank
and
you.
By
thank
the way,
you.
Other than there's no call on the 17th?
Right. That's
right.
Correct.
No call on
some... yep.
No. Yeah. Thank you.
More calls.
Thanks.
Thank
Take
you.
Care.
Thank you. Okay, thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Thank you.